I got married a couple years ago. You know, obviously it was a big deal. And I think, you know, as I think back to my playing days, it just, I think at the time, you know, I had a girlfriend when I was out there on tour. I was really trying to achieve the most I could in sports. And I think for me, it wasn't until after I had left the game that I really had to come full circle with myself, understand who I am as a person, where am I going, am I happy? And I had to come to terms with some things about my sexuality, and that was not easy, especially coming from a sports background.
Hey everyone, John Wertheim here. It is this week's Sports Illustrated / Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast. Our guest this week, Brian Vahely. Brian played at UVA. Very, very good college player, made a nice transition to the pros, got to top 100, was a regular at majors and other events, some very nice wins in his career, beat Juan Carlos Ferrero, and Juan Carlos Ferrero's the number one player in the world. He retired on account of injury and is now a venture capitalist. We talk a little bit about his tennis career, his relationship with the sport in retirement. We talk about what it's like for him to be a husband. We also talk about what it's like for Brian to have a husband. He married 2 years ago, now has two children. I didn't know this. Now lives in Annapolis, Maryland, a great city. Anyway, this is a nice conversation with a player who was always fun to cover 10, 12 years ago, Brian Vahely. It's our standard first question. Where are we getting you?
I live out on the water in Annapolis, but I'm in the I'm right in the D.C. area. That's where I work.
Oh, nice. I didn't realize that. Are you You commute, or can you work from home?
I commute. I work from home a couple days a week, and then I go in 3 days. So it's, you know, not ideal from a traffic standpoint, but you know, it's fine.
Don't text and drive. I was just telling someone. I said that Annapolis is like the Charleston of the Mid Atlantic. Annapolis, great town.
I love it. It is a wonderful town. The water. I feel remarkably patriotic for being there. You see all these folks walking around Navy and. It's just sort of a nice, small, more suburban feel to the sort of chaos of D.C. and when I was living there in the city for about 5 or 6 years.
I didn't realize you were there. That's a good landing spot. We have no agenda at these things. We sort of bounce around. But I was at an NBA event for players in their 40s and 50s the other day. And maybe we'll start here. I was really struck by how sort of complex their relationship with their sport still is. Some of them are still reliving the 1993 playoffs, and others don't even know what teams are good today. What's your relationship with tennis right now?
You know, I would say if you would have asked me that about 6 or 7 years ago, it sort of felt a little bit like a death in the family. Tennis was all you know about yourself. You define yourself that way. And how do you reinvent yourself knowing that you can't go back and do it again? There's adrenaline and competition and pressure that happens that you just cannot replicate in the real world. And I think you sort of seek to keep it alive by talking about it, by living it through it, by talking to friends who were there when those moments were happening. But for a period, I couldn't talk about it. I didn't like to be around it. I wasn't playing. I wasn't watching it. And I needed to sort of begin the process for me of letting it go and reinventing myself in a new career. And that's not what everybody does, right? A lot of people will stay around it and stay around it for the rest of their lives and either reflecting on their glory days or continuing to be a part of it. For me, it was just important. That wasn't a good fit for my personality. So I needed to move on to chapter two, I guess.
As I remember this, so you transitioned pretty quickly. I mean, you had the career 2.0 was something you entered pretty soon after your retirement, though, right? You didn't take five years bouncing around.
I struggled with I had to stop playing because of rotator cuff injuries. I had a bunch of surgeries and finally could not come back. And, you know, life after tennis was always in the back of my mind. And some of that may have been the way my parents raised me. Education was a big component. For me growing up, it was important to me to get a college degree. And frankly, there were a lot of people who beat up on me pretty bad in the juniors and in the college days that did not make it successfully as a pro. So I had no reason to think that I was going to do something that they could not. So I always wanted to be prepared for a backup plan. Fairly quickly, I'd say about a year, year and a half after I'd stopped competing, I was out there and on to the next chapter.
And you went to UVA, obviously. You didn't go there as, hey, I'm going to do this for a year and then turn pro. I mean, you sort of what went in as a freshman anticipating graduation, or were you sort of going to play it out and see where your game was going to take you?
Yeah, you know, at that point, I really didn't know. I mean, I was ranked 17 in the ITF in the world junior ranking. So, you know, one would think looking back, I had potential to go pro maybe earlier than I did.
Right.
You know, my family, we didn't have the experience or understanding. We weren't getting a lot of guidance on what the right path was. I knew I liked the idea of going to a college where I loved the academics and the athletics. I liked the idea of going and building something and sort of feeling like an entrepreneur in a new tennis environment and ecosystem, which at the time UVA was ranked, I believe, 50 when I made the decision to go. And, you know, would pro tennis be wonderful? Yeah, it'd be great, but it wasn't at the forefront of my decision. What was more important to my family, who was frankly calling the shots a lot at that point, was where can I get the best education? And I knew I wanted to jump into business. UVA had a very strong undergraduate business program. You know, it sort of just felt like a no-brainer to me. Maybe not for people who are, you know, at that point in time, hell-bent on being a professional tennis player.
UVA needs a coach. I think they need a women's coach too, actually.
I know, it's depressing. I've sort of loved this legacy, or not even legacy.
But that's sort of this lineage. You built this program up, and
you felt a part of it at the early days, and then to see him win national championship, you sort of get used to it, and now it's scary to think that might go away. But what Boland built there was incredible, and I'm super excited that he's going to be part of the USTA.
Someone, you know, Eric Schmidt leaves Google. I'm sure a successor will come in. What was your upbringing like? You didn't come from a tennis family, or you did?
I did not. You know, my family, I grew up in Camden, New Jersey, which was the, you know, the murder capital of the, I think, of the country. We quickly moved out of there to Cherry Hill for a while, then down to Atlanta. I really got involved in tennis because it was just a local park nearby. I actually saw Jaws at an early age, so I was terrified of going into the pool. And my parents, just to sort of keep me quiet, you know, threw me out on a tennis court. And I think I had really strong hand-eye coordination as a kid. And, you know, thinking back to those years, for me, it was really more about the attention I was getting. You know, you were a tennis player at four or five years old. Everybody thought you were great. And, you know, I think that sort of fed the love for it. And then as the years went on, it kind of kept building on itself. And as you keep winning, you just sort of explore more and more, and it starts at a city level, a state, sectionals, and, you know, national, international play. But definitely not anything my parents had in mind, you know, when the whole thing started.
I got to tell you, for all the programs I've heard at the USTA and elsewhere to get kids to play tennis, showing them shark movies has not come up before this. I think you're onto something.
I think I was terrified until I was about 10 years old. Somehow it got free, but it was, you know, it worked.
No shark bites and no head injuries. It's interesting.
Exactly.
I mean, you moved on to a career in finance, and I always thought that when you talked before about replicating the highs of being a tennis player, and others have talked about, there's, you know, at my job there's no scoreboard at the end of the day, and that's something that took time to get used to. I always thought that finance sort of provided that, or potentially provided that anyway.
It really just depends on what part of finance you're doing. Right now I'm in the venture capital space. So, you know, we're making investments in company at the very early stage, very similar to maybe what you would see on a Shark Tank. And, you know, we're not finding out how successful that's going to be at times for 3, 4, or 5 years. And that is painful for somebody like me who wants to go home. I want to be the winner. I want people to know that I've won, and I'd like to beat people in very hand-to-hand combat. And instead, you know, you oftentimes, this is about a long-term disciplined investment strategy, which, you know, you can still do the right things on a daily basis, but it feels like the tournament never really happens. And by the time you have won, those people who were maybe, you know, your doubters in the early days, they've sort of long moved past. And I think with tennis, you sort of felt like people would look you in the eye and say, I don't think you're good enough. I don't think you're tall enough, fast enough, strong enough. And then you could go onto a tennis court and prove them to be wrong. So there's an element of patience in finance, at least in what I'm particularly doing within venture capital, that I've had to learn. And
that's interesting.
It is frustrating, I will tell you. I miss it. I miss the feeling of winning, and I miss the what you learn from losing. And oftentimes you're not losing enough or fast enough in finance to be able to improve.
You're not losing fast enough. But what's your? I mean, I don't know what stage of a venture capital fund you have, but I mean, what's your batting average? I mean, if you're 1 for 4, are you happy?
Yeah. Oh, you'd be thrilled.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think that's interesting too, right?
It's unbelievably frustrating. I mean, and a lot of this has been a change over time. So you think about the junior and college days, you're going to win. My college record was probably, 45-2. And then you shift to the pro game and you're lucky to be at 500. And now you're shifting into, venture capital world and you're hoping to bat, maybe 15-20% of the time you hit a winner. So it's...
That's interesting. I mean, that doesn't make it easier in a sense. That you're not putting pressure on you to hit a home run every at bat.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. And I wish I could explain what the difference is, but maybe it's the affirmation you're getting from big wins that you sort of miss out on. And I think oftentimes you'll find the best tennis players will say one of the biggest things that drives them is the fear of losing.
Right.
Because the pain of losing can be really difficult. And it's just hard to me to feel like I'm making these risks knowing that, 80% of them are going to be losses. I always want to feel like I'm constantly winning. You got to just shift expectations a little bit.
That's interesting, actually. How was that for you as a player? Some people will tell you that the pain of losing, is a stronger emotion than the joy of winning. It's sort of classic loss aversion, right? That we make decisions
sure.
based on fear of loss more than the prospect of gain. On the other hand, I was looking at your, you beat Juan Carlos Ferreira when he was number one in the world. You beat Sam Querrey, took a set off Safin in Australia, an event he won. You had some real highs as a player.
Yeah. And those moments are great. I mean, I, got the opportunity to beat Michael Chang, who was sort of my role model growing up. I had some great wins at Indian Wells. And those moments certainly stick with me. And I could get goosebumps just thinking back to those. But the reality is those moments tend to be few and far between. I think in general, you'll find a lot of players talk about a feeling of relief with victory as opposed to, wow, this is an amazing moment. Let's go out there and celebrate. Even in times of victory, you always felt like there was another tournament coming next week. Now there's going to be more eyes looking on you. The pressure and expectations only grow as your ranking grows.
Right.
So the opportunity to really sit there and enjoy that moment is really not really there. What is there is the feeling of pain of loss, and especially losing to people you're not supposed to lose to, and doing it on a very public forum in front of friends, family, and your peers. And that loss sits with you all day. It can sit with you, depending on the size of the loss or the size of the choke, it can send for you for a year. And those moments of victory just don't last that long, unfortunately.
I have a UVA degree to fall back on. Is that blunting your, is that a help or a hindrance when you're out there trying to make it?
It was a big help because it was able to take pressure off.
Right.
One of the things that I think makes players great is when they can really loosen up and play their best tennis in the biggest stages. And unfortunately, it is just very difficult when a lot of people are watching or the big moments come to actually be able to do that. And for me, I always tried to rely on, this is not my everything.
Right.
This is about me going to be the best I can be, to have the most fun I can. And you're always trying to find what that lie is you need to tell yourself to enable you to relax in the big moments. Some people, that's, I'm the greatest person in the world. I can beat anybody. For other people, it's, hey, this isn't that big of a deal. I've got an education to fall back on. There's always stories you're telling yourself, songs you're singing to yourself.
Stories, narrative sounds better than lies. But my favorite is always I have to prove the doubters. Floyd Mayweather will be a 13-1 favorite to win and will say, nobody respects me. I'm out to prove the doubters wrong. You sort of say, that's what you tell yourself.
For me, without a doubt, the narrative in my brain would change based on who I was competing against. And there was a feeling in certain players, I want to be able to prove them wrong, and that inspired me. And others, it was like, I'm trying to relax myself and like, hey, there's a life outside of it. And I tried to take my vision almost at a 10,000, foot view of the court to try and relax myself. You really have to be able to know what words, what things to say, what things to draw upon based on the moment you're experiencing to get yourself back at neutral. Because the truth is, your emotions are kind of all over the place when you're out there.
It's really depending on the
wind conditions, on the player that you're playing against, on the fans that are there, the quantity of fans, how angry they are at you. I mean, there's a million variables you got to go through. You know, and I think the mental side of it is just is important to, at least it was for me, to just to figure out how to get into that headspace so that I could play the best that I could.
To me, this is always just as interesting, if not more so, than what is he doing with this cross court backhand. But I was thinking to myself, you have something very few former athletes have. That's a husband. I didn't want to start here. We're all more than our sexual orientation. But I also think this is sort of significant. You got married 2 years ago, didn't you?
I got married a couple of years ago. Yeah, and it was a big deal. And I think, you know, at the time, you know, as I think back to my playing days, it just, you know, you're so focused on your sport, you're so focused on winning, on being, you recognize what a short window competition is, and you don't want to do anything to distract from that. And I think at the time, you know, I had a girlfriend when I was out there on tour. I was really trying to achieve the most I could in sports. And I think for me, it wasn't until after I had left the game that I really had to come full circle with myself, understand who I am as a person, where am I going, am I happy? And I had to come to terms with some things about my sexuality, and that was not easy, especially coming from a sports background. And it really caused me for a long period of time to want to understand it, to not really want to talk about it, to, you know, it was a long learning curve, that I'm happy to be on the other side of now. And thankfully, you know, over the last few years, found someone, got married a couple years back, most recently had, two kids via surrogate, and, you know, it's been it's sort of the fastest way to describe what has felt like an extremely journey over the last 10 years.
It's really interesting to me because, I mean, it sounds as though when we talk about sort of, in other cases, we talk about the psychic energy it must take it in some ways for athletes who, you know, are pondering whether to come out or concealing orientation. It sounds as though something you sort of postponed dealing with until after you were done playing. Is that accurate?
You know, I think I must have put a lot of energy when I was competing, and I probably didn't know it. But I think there was always this feeling of wanting to be a little bit, I became really great at asking other people questions and being everybody's friend, but being very private myself. And maybe because I didn't want to have to ask those personal questions of myself. And that was sort of a defense mechanism that I built up over a period of time when I was out there on tour. I think afterwards for me, it was, you know, I didn't really want, especially directly after I finished competing and I was starting to come to terms with it, you know, a year or two right after I was done, I didn't want to look back on my career and be known for my sexuality as the primary memory of what I was able to accomplish. So because, you know, when you work at something for 25 years, you get up and, you know, 5 a.m. and you're training after school and you're missing high schools and proms and graduations and, you know, I sacrificed a lot to pull a lot of great moments and wins and experiences out of somebody like me, who frankly wasn't the most athletic, wasn't the most talented, but I fought like hell, and I wanted to be remembered for that, and I wanted to be remembered for work I had done with my foundation. I wanted to be seen as the guy who, you know, really was persevering and told a lot of the doubters that I could accomplish something that I could not.
You think this would have sort of rewritten and trumped?
Yeah,
everything.
I mean, I think especially in the early days, you know, all of a sudden you quickly become the athlete that was gay.
Right.
And I just did not, at that point in time, and that level of my confidence, security, you know, and frankly, understanding of myself, that's just not how I wanted to be remembered by. And, you know, so I, for very selfish reasons, just sort of thought, you know what, this is something I'm going to explore on my own. I never sort of saw myself being a pioneer or an advocate to go out there and really talk about it. It just was something that I had to come to terms with. I had to sort of mourn the life that I thought I was going to be living, you know, with a wife with kids and a, you know, this life that I thought I was building. You know, kind of realize what the new normal was going to look like. And the new normal was exciting and it is great, but it was tough to go through. And I think at the time I was looking at it more from my lens and not wanting to attach that adjective as the first adjective people remembered about me.
What do you think? I mean, have you thought about how accepting the workforce would have been had you made a different decision? I mean, do you think tennis would have would this have been welcomed? Would this have been? People ask us all the time, right? I mean, this is sort of I think a natural after Jason Collins. I mean, I think there was a lot of why are there no out male tennis players, and what would it be like if someone did decide to come out during their playing career? And I think people have all sorts of opinions, but I think you're uniquely suited to. I don't know if it's something you've thought about or have opinions of, but I think it's an interesting hypothetical.
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, I'm sure it could have been more tough in the locker room environment. I mean, it is everybody's extremely friendly. It's a nice environment there. I don't think it could have been a huge problem, but certainly there are going to be people that this having a gay person there could have the likelihood or potential to offend. I don't think that's everybody, but certainly that's out there. And I think in general, you know, you always want to feel like one of the guys who gets along well with everybody, who can be a part of every conversation, who's not going to be offended or, you know, cause any sort of controversy or problem. And I think the fear sort of would have been, you know, are people going to act differently around me if, you know, if this were to be the case? What do I do with some of the comments maybe from some players who may have, you know, who may not agree with homosexuality? You know what? It felt like a variable that at that point in time was something that I didn't want to add fuel to. And maybe that was sort of my desire to want to be the best player I could be, to have the best relationships with other players that I could. You sort of just didn't want to rock the boat. And I think that's, you know, that's just kind of all I can sort of speak to is the maturity level that I was at that time. I think if you looked at it today, I think the odds are it would be a much more welcoming environment than maybe perhaps it was in the early 2000s.
I was going to say, I think we need to timestamp this too, because 10 years, 12 years, 15 years doesn't seem like a lot of time, but I think views on this issue have really evolved and transformed in the last 10, 12 years.
Oh, of course. I mean, it was, yeah, you got to take yourself back to sort of, you know, Bush being in office and wanting a constitutional amendment on marriage. And, you know, there's a lot of angry, divisive talk about the subject. And I think people felt very open to express their views on it. So when you sort of hear that sort of language that's constantly happening around you, I think intuitively or instinctively, that was sort of another reason for me to not want to explore that. Right. It was just something I would hold on to very tightly. I think now, you know, you see a lot of guys who are much more, I think back then too, if you sort of even were friends with gay people, that was somehow a reflection of you and your own sexuality. So they were sort of stigmatized in that way. And I think now you see even some of the best athletes in the world who are saying, hey, I think this is great. I support the cause. I support the initiative. I'm still married to my wife,
right,
but I think
right.
this is a great thing. And I support it. And that kind of leadership did not exist at that time.
Exactly. I mean, I always tell the story, you know, I say this as, you know, heteronormative, cisgendered white male, but, you know, I mean, my kids will laugh when, did you hear that? They said sexual preference. You can't say sexual preference. And I'm thinking to myself, that's great that you're drawing these distinctions, but, you know, I had gym teachers that, you know, use the dreaded F word to describe people. I mean, the distance traveled, I can't think of a social issue that's, I mean, again, I say that from a certain perspective, but it seems like we've come very far in a very short amount of time. And
It has evolved a lot. I mean, shoot, I'm seeing now, you know, I think what my friends told me, Tinder has like 56 different options of things you can self-identify with. I mean, I'm not sure that I understand a lot of that. I'm still probably learning that as much as anybody else is. But, you know, certainly seeing the acceptance has made things tremendously easier on me now, has made things, I believe, will make things a lot easier on my kids. You know, and that obviously is what sticks out for me as, you know, you talk about life after tennis and trying to find a sense of identity and purpose and a relationship with the sport, but also self-awareness. And I think, you know, having a couple kids that you want to create a certain life for, it becomes very, a huge focus of mine now, and seeing that, you know, my marriage is something that can be accepted and celebrated in the community and will not be a problem for them growing up is extremely important to me.
How old are your kids?
They are 10 months.
Twins, right?
Two twin boys.
Oh, boy.
So we went through the whole surrogacy process, and which was about a year and a half pain and ungodly expensive, but incredibly worth it when it all finally happened. But the first 4 months they were alive, I was losing my mind. Two people screaming at you in both ears is something that I don't wish on my worst enemy.
I was going to say the first, but you're in the clear now, right? I mean, I'm thinking
now they're sleeping through the
night.
It is great. Yeah, they have this great relationship with each other. It is awesome. I absolutely love it. The 10-month period is fantastic. The first 3 or 4 months, I wanted to run away.
That I say that there's no sugarcoating sleep deprivation, and twins is just I don't know how you.
Yeah, I mean it was. They were at least one kid was awake 23 hours a day for I think 2 months.
Iced coffee. I hope you have grandparents.
A lot of caffeine.
Your kids in a few years say, "Dad, I want to play tennis. I want to get serious about this sport." What are you telling them? What advice would you give them that you wish someone had given you when you started to get serious?
Gosh, you know, it's so funny as you look back. I mean, I have experienced so much in life because of tennis. And, you know, if you really look at successful players' history, you know, their background, they oftentimes have a very combative relationship with the sport and combative relationship with their parents. And it's a, you know, there is a lot to it. But yet, had I not experienced all of that, I wouldn't be sort of standing where I am today. So, of course, in many cases, you want your kids to play tennis. You want them to learn and grow as a person and all the things that the sport gives you. On the other hand, now that I know how much work it is and how painful it is, I'm sort of hoping they'll pick another sport.
Is that right?
You know, it'd be great if they played golf or, you know, something, you know, I'll introduce them to golf. Lacrosse is really big up around here. I'm certainly going to put them to tennis, but I don't, in many cases, I really want them to play tennis because of what I believe are really strong life lessons you get as a result of playing it. But I also live in fear of them trying to compare any of their results or anything like that to things I was able to accomplish. So whatever, we'll find a middle ground.
I was going to say we don't, what's the cliche? You don't have the kids you expect to have.
That's what I would imagine.
Remote control.
I'm hoping they just like sports. I think there's so much to be gained in sports and competition and pressure and winning and losing and all that. So I'm really hopeful that I don't get a 100% artistic child, but if I do, I will love them either way.
I don't know if you've seen, someone sent me some videos of Andre Agassi's kid.
Mm-hmm.
Who's he's got a mean curveball. He's this great,
really?
He's probably 15 years old, and he's a tremendous baseball player. But again, we don't get to remote control our kids.
I know. It does excite me at the thought of experiencing or learning or being a part of a new sport and a new culture in some regard. So I'm, whatever, we'll see how it goes.
You were on the UST board for several years. Is that right?
I was. I was on the national board from 2013 to 14, and now I'm back on starting January of this year.
What do you see the USTA's role in this crazy sport? I mean, sort of these, you know, these divide. I mean, you're in a company and you see business plans and the structure sort of is what it is. And I feel like one of the beauties of tennis, but also one of the frustrations, are that, never mind the players, even administratively, these lines of demarcation get a little blurry. Where can the USTA fit in here?
You know, for me, what they are doing, so obviously, you know, most of my interaction with the USTA growing up was in player development, and seeing where they are today, which has been creating so much more of a sort of inclusive environment. Back when I was competing, you were trying to be one of the one or two golden childs of the USTA.
Right.
And that was sort of, you know, if you were either one of them or you were not, and that was the ticket to wild cards, to grants, to everything. You know, what they are doing now under Martin Blackman has been incredible to see. And it's very encouraging because I went through some really tough years back in the early to mid 90s. And now they have just, they're just making it more fair and making it more open to more players and giving more players an opportunity and stop thinking that they can pick out a player at 16 years old and know the future. So from a player development perspective, I'm super excited about it. And I think, you know, what we're doing at the US Open is, I mean, I don't know, to me, it's just one of the most amazing tournaments to be a part of. So I'm extremely encouraged by that. I think where the exciting opportunity is how to continue to expand the game at a grassroots level. And what can we be doing to get more kids into the game and stop the what I believe at times to be a misconception that unless you're sort of come from a middle to upper class family, you know, that's the only way tennis is going to be for you. I think we need to, you know, sort of continue some of the outreach initiatives to, you know, expand people playing as much as you can. I feel so strongly that what tennis and the life skills that come from playing the sport can bring to people that, you know, one of the main reasons I serve on the board is just how we can get more people out there playing.
That's great. I mean, I you know, it's, at some level, what you're describing with player development sounds not dissimilar to venture capital, right? You sort of back you back a few startups and a few projects that you feel strongly about. But I think you're right. And the thing that always drives me crazy is, yes, tennis gets very expensive when you start playing professionally. Recreational tennis, especially if there's a public court, as there are in so many neighborhoods. You know, mm-hmm. you spend $150 on a racket that's going to last you a few years. A can of balls costs the same thing now as it did when I was a kid. You know, when start taking private lessons, it's a different story. But I think this misconception of tennis as country club sport is something that can really be attacked. I mean, I don't know if that figures in, but
I'm hopeful that we will do that because I think it's it is. I'd love to see not only was it sort of great for me for a variety of reasons of playing, but it was fun for my family. I mean, we always had a great time together, you know, going out, playing on the court, just sort of laughing, having a great time. I think it's a great sport in that regard. And frankly, I am sort of thankful that, you know, 10 years after retiring, I can still go out and play. So it's something that is continuing to be fun for me. It's great, certainly from a business standpoint now. I am very thankful and appreciative that tennis is my sport, and I would love for I just think more people need to get out there and do it. So I think the USTA is doing a great job, but I think we can even do a better job.
Let me ask you one last question. Since I've always wondered this, and I think it's very hard to message, but I think, you know, you look at the number of players, former players that are in finance now. Some of them doing quite well. You know, Richard Rennenberg, and I mean, there's a whole Jim Grab. There's a number of players that have made a nice transition. I don't know if those opportunities are there. I mean, I don't know how you feel personally. If tennis doesn't enter your life, are you doing what you're doing now? But how can it's tough to message, but how can you get it out there that tennis you'll avail yourself to opportunities perhaps that might not otherwise be there? But that makes sense. I didn't ask that very cleanly, but you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, tennis certainly opens a lot of doors in life. It just does. So, you know, whether it more lends itself to a, you know, career down the road and finance, I think we have certainly proven there's a lot of players from the ATP Tour specifically that have transitioned well into the finance world.
Right.
And I think that's, you know, for a variety of reasons, but I think, you know, to sort of answer your question, is tennis going to get you there? I mean, I think it's a piece of it. I don't have a great answer.
I always say, and it's a little bit icky to say, hey, play tennis. Look, you never know what kind of connections and what kind of exposure this will lead to. But I just think there's something there that tennis.
There is no doubt, like relationships through sports,
exactly,
is a critical component as you get older and in the business world. It is very important. And yes, there are a lot of very successful people who love to play tennis.
Wait, boom!
So
your
odds of getting the opportunity to, you know, to meet those people as a result of playing the game goes up incrementally. That's sort of, you know, without a doubt, and is, you know, one of the main reasons the U.S. Open does so well from a sponsorship standpoint,
because
a lot of the people who love tennis and who love to watch tennis, you know, come from a certain demographic. But, you know, sometimes I hate to emphasize that point too much because I want the accessibility of the sport to still be there.
Exactly.
I want people to know
tricky,
that, hey, come out there, you can play. This is not just for a certain crust of people. This is an opportunity to, you know, grow yourself in a new sport.
No, I think you're right. I think it's really tricky, but I also think that for a lot of parents, if you've got a talented 6-7-year-old and you're trying to figure out what sport to play, tennis has virtues that go beyond the purse that top players make. That makes sense. Anyway, absolutely. longer discussion. But this was this was great. I really appreciate this. Good catching up. I think I'm a good go find your unicorn. I think if you go 1 for 4, go 1 for 4 in venture capital.
1 from 4, I'll be rich and famous, living in the Hamptons, and it'll be wonderful.
Stay in Annapolis. this was a lot of fun.
Yeah, no, I appreciate it. Thanks for the time.
All right, we'll talk soon. All right, thanks to Brian Vahaly for spending some time talking candidly about a number of topics. That was good talk, as we say, good talk. I'm John Wertheim. Jamie Lasanti is our producer. Keep your suggestions coming. They've been really good, and we've drawn a number of guests from your podcast suggestions, so thanks for those. Thanks for listening. You can get the SI Tennis Channel Tennis Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever fine podcasts are sold. I'm John Wertheim. We'll talk again in 7 days.